Louisiana incarcerates nearly twice the national average rate in the US. They just chuck everyone in prison, basically. And their rate of wrongful conviction is pretty high. Now, bear in mind, they have the death penalty for capital cases. That can be pretty severe for some. And when Hurricane Katrina came... Are we actually working here? Yeah, we are. Great. Just not that one. Never mind. It was just a title. Don't worry about it. When Hurricane Katrina came... it is working. I read this little article and I thought all the news strands were doing everything about the violence in the Super Bowl stadium where everyone had fled to and the looting and the complete disaster that New Orleans had fallen into. And I read this article and I thought, that's really extraordinary that people's lives have been affected. Obviously, they're affected by the hurricane, but in a very different way, in the place where actually people should be safe, in prison. So I trotted down the corridor to the This World department that was corresponding that day, which is BBC Two's main foreign affairs strand, and I said to the editor, please, can I go? And she said, okay. And at that point, the flooding had only been drained for a couple of weeks. Nothing was functioning. There was one hotel open for international media that was running on generators and food being shipped in. There were no hire cars available because the world's media were trying to be there. And I was just lucky. There happened to be a BBC cameraman who was coming out. She said, you can have his hotel room and his hire car. You've got a week. Come back with a story. So I got on a plane, which was delayed. So I landed quite late, got my hire car, and they still had an 8 o'clock curfew. And I was driving through the streets of Louisiana where there was no power, and they'd just put signs. We were going the wrong way up streets and no idea how to find this hotel. And this massive Humvee pulled up next to me, and two soldiers looked down. I had the window, and I went, hello! And they both just looked at me and went, so we drove away really fast. And I managed to literally just get to the hotel on the skin of my teeth without being arrested on day one. But long story short, it turned out that Hurricane Katrina, when the whole of the city was evacuated, the prison that was in the lowest lying area of the city, they shut and locked in all the prisoners. They locked it down. They had nearly 8,000 prisoners. It flooded normally when it rained. When the hurricane came in, all the electrics went, obviously, and those prisoners stood mostly in water on the lower levels up to their neck. Now, bearing in mind what's in that water... You know, all the scum off the streets, all the sewage systems that had overflown, etc. Horrific. And then they started, after 3 days, shipping them out. Literally, let's see if he's working. This is New Orleans prison afterwards. They literally started boating them out, six at a time, onto an overpass that was nearby. So these people had been... standing in water, completely prune-like, for 3 days, and then shoved onto an overpass and sat in rows in over 100 degrees heat. No food, no water. This is where they were being brought out, to the overpass. And then they just got bussed to other facilities across the state and all just put in large exercise yards. All the computers had gone down. No one knew who anybody was. They would throw sandwiches over the fence to feed them. They didn't know... So Louisiana has an extraordinary mix of prisoners. So you'll get arrested for jaywalking, for reading tarot cards, for traffic violations. You get locked up until your court case comes. In with those who are brought back to the courthouse for reviews of those who are convicted murderers, rapists, and gang crime was an enormous problem in the Ninth Ward of Louisiana. New Orleans is a great party place for tourists, but if you step out of Bourbon Street, it has a very unsavoury underbelly as a place. It's a very, very poor area. And what happened with Katrina was it literally cracked open the justice system. And they would open the gate and say to people, who are you and what are you in for? And everyone went, traffic violation, sleeping on the sidewalk. Well, yeah, right, okay, not everyone's in here for traffic violation. And there were a handful of women, two particular amazing defence attorneys, Phyllis Mann and Julie Kilbourne, and they said, well, this ain't on, in their lovely American accent. And they came along, they got an old printout that was several days old of who had been in the prison, and they went through 7,500 prisoners and through a variety of ways worked out who was who. And those that shouldn't have been there were released and bussed back, because by law, if they were released, they had to be released from the prison they'd been arrested in. They were given $10, And most of them, at that time there was no transport, there was nothing happened, and they were just left in the prison. Their families had all fled the Ninth Ward, they didn't have mobile phones, they couldn't walk before the curfew hit at 8 o'clock back to the Ninth Ward, which is where most of them came from. So they just got rearrested. They didn't know where their families were, they couldn't even make it to their homes to see if a message had been left for them. Just have a little watch of this.
This is where the evacuated prisoners were meant to appear. Orleans Parish Criminal Courthouse, the front of the prison complex. For all its grandeur, it's brought neither law nor order to a city notorious for murder. The senior judge was Calvin Johnson.
At one point in this court's history, we were trying more cases in this building than any other court in Louisiana. And we had judges in this building, including me, actually, who year in and year out would try more murder trials than any other judge in America.
This is how the courthouse looked when Katrina struck. It stayed closed for 9 months, with makeshift courts elsewhere hearing only a fraction of the normal caseload, leaving judges with a backlog of over 6,000 cases.
Katrina blew the system apart, and it made it such that we were so disconnected that we simply could not function.
It seems extraordinary in a building prone to flooding, but vital forensic evidence was stored in the basement. The fate of thousands of defendants now rests on evidence in these rooms. Rape kits and weapons, fingerprint and drug samples are now contaminated beyond rescue. The guilty may go free, and the falsely convicted, who could have won reprieves, now may have no hope.
The items were all over the place because of the water. And so it was just one incredible mess. The evidence is all tagged. Without being able to read the tag, we don't know really what connection this stuff in this bag has with a particular case.
In Louisiana, rape and murder are capital crimes. For the wrongly convicted, DNA testing has been a godsend in getting convictions overturned. But if the evidence is spoilt for those on death row, it could mean the difference between life or death.
To a great extent, that evidence has been totally destroyed, and they'll never be able to recover any DNA from it. There will be people, and I've got one in particular that I'm worried about. And if this had not happened, if they had stored the evidence in a safe place, maybe DNA would have exonerated them. Those are the people that I feel sorriest for.
So, to put this into context, it's estimated in the US that actually mistaken eyewitness identifications tend to be the highest reason for wrongful conviction. And in Louisiana, they're allowed to have one eyewitness in order to put someone away, and that can be for a capital crime. In Louisiana, they've had 14 DNA exonerations where people were put away without DNA evidence previously. And those 14 men have served a total of 267 and a half years between them, wrongfully convicted. There's a rate in the US as a total that they think about one in 25 is a wrongful conviction. And when I was there, I spent some time in Angola, which is the state penitentiary, which, bizarrely, when Hurricane Katrina happened, they put all the female prisoners in the all-male prison. Very, very odd. But it is so large, it has its own zip code. And the governor there has wolves, which he releases when people escape. It's the most extraordinary thing. And they took me to visit death row. And I walked down a corridor of men who live 23 hours a day in cells, which are, they're literally six foot by 3 foot. And I looked them in the eye, and every single one of them had absolutely no light in their eyes. It's like their souls had gone. And you walk down and you think, my goodness, somebody here statistically is very probably innocent. When I left that night, I was very, very grateful that we are lucky to have our freedom, because when you look at those people and how they live, and the average person's on death row for 12 years, that's enough to kill your soul and get rid of any kind of hope. And people give up on them because predominantly they are poor and black. So Katrina was a really interesting place to work, and you know, it gave me a real passion for justice. And in America, heavens, it's that bad. You know, what else goes on in lots of other places? As a journalist, what we're trying to do is take issues around the world and turn them into stories. Why? Because we need to engage our audiences, and your target audience is very different if it's, you know, a Today programme, Radio 4 programme, or if it's a BBC 3 for 18 to 35-year-olds. You need to turn issues into engaging stories that will capture that particular audience. So we take issues from all around the world, and we use storytelling skill sets in order to capture people's imagination. And we have to have extraordinary access and authenticity. Particularly as an investigative journalist, the whole point is revelation. You're meant to learn something along the way. Working in foreign affairs brings with it a whole bunch of other interesting things. So there's a whole language thing going on. I don't speak many of the languages of the places you go to. So you're kind of working quite blind in many ways, and particularly in areas where there's been trauma or very difficult issues, you really learn to read body language and trust your instincts and communicate with people in different ways. You also have to learn local cultures and societal traditions and practice. I've had to turn up in villages and drink fresh goat's blood, which was still warm, because that was the welcome, and if you didn't do it, you offended everyone. You just got to close your eyes and go, okay, wasn't on my menu for lunch, but we'll go with it, because otherwise we haven't got a film. And my favourite sticky situation was working on the border of northern Kenya and Ethiopia, and it was very, very remote. We were doing a film about food insecurity, and people there were literally eating a handful of corn a day. That's all they had. And there was a lot of corruption in food aid, and we were making a film about that. Anyway, the fixer had gone ahead of us to get permission of this village to allow us to come and visit. They'd never seen a white person before. And we turned up, and they'd literally that week dug out their first ever pit latrine. And they were so proud of it. Lovely big hole and a hut around it, two-thirds of the way. And the front third was open. And they'd congregated the 200 members of the village, and they asked me to christen it for them in front of the whole village. I was like, I'm not getting my white butt out in front of you lot. This is a bit embarrassing. So I convinced them that the reporter was way more important than me, and I hope they understood that in my culture I would offend him immensely if he didn't do it. So he turned his back and dutifully did the job, but got me out of it. But you end up having to, you kind of have to become a chameleon and blend into the places you're in and learn how to bond with people on their level incredibly quickly in order to gain a story, particularly if you're working in news where you're in very quickly and in hostile environments where you have very little time. And that brings with it a huge responsibility of duty of care to the people that you're interviewing, and that they really understand what you're doing, etc. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about that along the way. One of the big things in duty of care is working with vulnerable people. I've done an awful lot of work with children and women, mainly because I'm female and therefore I'm a suitable person to do that. And I've worked on stories in child labour all over the world, in Cocoa and Ivory Coast and various places. I just want to show you this clip. This is in Nepal. There we go. That one's working. We're talking about child labour now. This one's in Malawi. Just have a look at this clip.
This is 9-year-old Lifa. She and her sister suffer from severe headaches, symptoms of nicotine poisoning. Like thousands of children, they work with tobacco for up to 12 hours a day. Tobacco that's bought by major cigarette manufacturers and sold to smokers around the world.
They also say their supervisors beat them, sometimes with their hands and sometimes with sticks.
We've come to Malawi to meet the children who suffer because of the world's addiction to tobacco.
So for these children, picking tobacco all day is the equivalent of smoking 40 cigarettes a day. That's why they get headaches. And the other thing is they get yellow-stained fingers. You know how a smoker has yellow-stained fingers from the tobacco leaves? They're incredibly potent. These are the kids we were filming with. This is little Lifa. She was 9. Which means they then, even if they do have time to go to school, they don't go because they are they're the tobacco kids. I was filming in Malawi. And they get picked on at school. So even if they were going to go, they're kind of in this cycle with everything against them. And making films like this has a whole bunch of issues. From a filmmaking perspective, the minute you land in a country, you fall under their law. So making things like this, we're trespassing, for starters. There, we are working with children. Whenever you film in Africa, that's what happens straight away. It's very challenging. All the children want to look at what you're doing. It's very hard to get a nice, clean shot of a landscape. You have to take lots of sweets and things and distract them elsewhere with a reporter while you quickly get some shots. So they work long, long hours, and they are very vulnerable. You have to ensure that through duty of care, we work under the British journalism, and documentary particularly, has some of the strictest compliance and legals and contingency stuff for working with vulnerable people. And that's men, women and children, particularly as trauma. But with children, you've got to be so aware, because the potential ramifications on them and their family. You can get on the plane and go home, thank you very much, that's lovely, you're done. What happens to them when you leave? And working with children, that's a very difficult call to make, because an adult, people and trauma aside, there's a whole different, you know, way of deciding whether people really understand what they're contributing to and what the potential ramifications or reprisals may be for them. But with children, you have to have an adult or someone or a good reason to broadcast their stories, knowing that you're making them vulnerable in some way if, you know, your film gets back. When we were making these films, there was almost a slight comfort because it was before we went digital. So in these days, my tapes that I would shoot, so from Malawi, the government got wind of what we're doing. Tobacco is the largest source of GDP. They don't want it upset as an industry. And we knew that. The fixer had already been arrested. We got him back 3 days later. So I copied all of my tapes from one camera to another camera overnight the night before we left. We left one lot buried in the fixer's mother's garden to be DHL'd out later. And the rest I literally hid in my underwear to get out with my tapes. And I knew who had my material. I knew I was in control of it. Today, with the advent of digital, we upload everything. The minute you've done that, you've lost control of who is able to see what people have told you. Now, what you see in a film is a fraction of what's actually filmed. We film an awful lot, and you end up with very short cut interviews. And there are a lot of people who don't actually make it into a film for one reason or another. But they're still vulnerable. If that material is, it falls into the wrong place. And with the advent of the digital age, and particularly investigative journalism and foreign affairs, has become very tricky to navigate the moral elements of ensuring that people understand what they're doing and that they are signed up to what you're doing, who's going to see it, and what the potential reprisal will be. You know what, you can get a phone signal in the Virungas in the back end of nowhere, and I can't get it frequently in London. They skipped landlines, and they went straight for Chinese 4G technology. You know, it's a lot better in the back end of nowhere in Africa than it is here. So we need to be very aware of that. But issues, when we deal with these issues, they're never black and white. Do we believe that child labour is wrong? Yeah, pretty much. I guess most of us would sign up to that. Do their families believe that they would really rather their kids were in school? Yeah. But you know what? If their kids don't pick and don't work, they don't meet the quota for the farmer, they can't feed them. What do you do? Let your child die of starvation or make them work for you? There is never, ever a black and white answer to any issue in the world. And navigating those is one of the very great responsibilities of storytelling. And working out how we portray what happens in places and how we deal with quite sensitive stuff can be quite tricky. And, of course, the fun of doing tobacco is all the big tobacco companies are based in the States with a jolly lot of money, and they love to sue everybody. I was a series producer on Dispatches for some time, and that goes out at 8 o'clock on Channel 4, And at 6 o'clock, you'd wait for the phone call. Yeah, the court injunction's come in. Whoever you have tried to accuse of something, and they've had a right to reply. We've been through all the right legals, but they always wait till 6 o'clock on Monday night in the hope that you cannot justify that everything stands up in court fast enough for it to be broadcast. I've never not had a film go out yet. And interestingly, most people don't realise that actually the robustness of good investigative journalism is down to the legal team. Because you've got 20 minutes. You've worked with a lawyer all the way on these programmes, but you've then got 20 minutes to brief them as to how they're going to convince the judge that your journalism is so watertight and the allegations you've made are in public interest and watertight enough that they'll stand up in a court of law in time for your film to go out at 8 o'clock. And everyone at Channel 4 gets really tetchy if we haven't got that through by 5 to 8. And they're looking for a rerun of something else instead. So it can be quite tense, but we've always made it by the cut of our teeth. But, you know, stories like this come loaded with terribly challenging legal and moral issues, and it's only, you never learn how to navigate them. Every single one is different, and you have to kind of guide it with a moral compass and a journalistic integrity and do the best you can at the end of the day. Right, I'm chatting away too much. Let's move on. The other thing that is very linked in with child labour is the issue of trafficking and slavery. So child labour, trafficking and slavery are all very much inextricably linked. I've done lots of films about this as well, and I firmly believe that slavery is our modern day scourge. It really is. Do you know, I mean, figures are very, very hard. Never really trust figures. We don't really know. But the best estimates are there are currently 25 million people in slavery now. 25 million. That is worse than at any time of our history that we've documented. Everyone thinks of slavery, it was, you know, cotton picking in America. Oh, no, this is on a whole other scale. And it's very much more hidden than it ever was. Very much more hidden. Slavery is all entwined in trafficking, obviously, and quite often there's children and women involved. Everyone knows Stacey Dooley? Did you all watch Strictly Come Dancing? Bless her. I made her first four ever films with her over 10 years ago when she was fresh and naive and 19, straight out of Luton. She'd never even been on the tube to London. She's a very big-hearted girl. She left school at 16, and she's gone on to, actually, with a lot of passion and heart, she works for her BBC Three target audience. She's not everyone's cup of tea, but she cares, and, you know, really good honour. She's been doing films for 10 years now. But this was the second film that we made together. Just have a watch.
Word has spread that a film crew is in the area, and all the surrounding workshops closed down. But before the team have a chance to move on, a frightened young boy comes to Ira, the translator.
नम साउ साउ कांटेक्ट नहीं करा देता
नहीं
नहीं
He's been hustled twice. Person just picks him up, slaps him on the floor.
He's scared. He was working in a factory just up the road to where we were, so the factory owner threw him out to shut the factory so we don't see, and said they've come to arrest you, like to scare him. He gets beat every day, quite badly. He's been in hospital twice. The owner just picks him up and slaps him on the floor. Can we do anything at this moment?
We can rescue him. If he wants to go, no. First, we have to request to police to rescue him.
So the next step is to find the police and ask them to rescue him.
Yeah, we can.
Let's do that today.
Today?
Yeah.
Today I can.
Why not?
We can.
Okay.
The boy has claimed to have been abused by the factory bosses, which means the charity workers can start the process of rescuing him. To take him into care, the charity will need a letter of authority from the police. But the police are short on resources, so can often be slow to react. Saga is hoping the presence of a Western film crew will force them to move quickly.
If I go alone, it takes a long time. If we go with press, it will be a kind of pressure also.
Off to the police station. I think I'll be here on my trip. This morning we were planning to just have a look at a lot of factories so we could just, you know, compare them all and get a bigger sort of picture of how bad it is. And the afternoon has... took a different turn.
So this little boy, we'd literally just been filming, this is him, the day we rescued him. We'd literally just been filming in the area, he appeared next to us, and his story unfolded. The point about this is how we are perceived is something that we really need to consider. And in filmmaking, before we go anywhere, in our risk assessments and all our planning, The two things that I do more than anything is go through every single what-if scenario. What if this happens while we're doing this? What if this happens? All the possible what-ifs. And then you do all the impossible what-ifs because they're the ones that always happen. and here, these are girls who were slain. Her sister was in bond. They were both in bonded labour. And we managed to rescue them as well and reunite them with their families. But this little boy, he'd come to next to us. So first of all, so we'd taken along the charity worker just in case something like this happens, because we have no powers to, and it's not our place to rescue. There's a question of, A, is his story true? How do we verify he's telling the truth and his mum isn't round the corner thinking, you're potentially a source of cash for us, because I'm going to give you a bleeding heart story? It happens a lot. And you know what? If you have nothing, don't blame them. That's fine. So first of all, we have to work out whether that is actually what his story is actually true. We decided we're going to agree, and it is. But the perception of us as a Western film crew for him was that we were his way out. And good on him, you know? Good on him. Long story short, it turned out the charity took him back. It turned out he had been trafficked from India. They reunited him with his family. His family had given him to an uncle because the uncle had said, we're going to take him for you, give him a really good education and more than you could give him. His uncle sold him into trafficking and he was working in factories in Nepal. It's very common there, sadly. And, this is not something we had planned in our filming events, but we took it along and it was a very powerful story in film and the little boy got reunited. But trafficking and slavery is really horrific in our modern day society. Tonight, when you all go to bed, spare a thought for the estimated 13,000 women in the UK who are enslaved. Going to sleep in fear, enslaved, and most of them completely dehumanised to keep them entrapped. 13,000 is the estimate in the UK. This is not a problem just for legislation, for government. This is not a how awful of the perpetrators, or we all need to step up and take responsibility. We don't need to go and make films about it. You know, you can do your own thing. If you're Christian, you can pray about it. You can give financially to organisations that fight it. Or you can just advocate. Teach your children what's going on around us. It's not just elsewhere. It's in the UK as well. Whatever you think of Theresa May, she introduced the Modern Slavery Act, and it is the most robust legislation in the world we have here against modern-day slavery. But the government doesn't have the resources to follow it up. You know, we all have to take responsibility and change our attitudes and our worldviews in order to shift things. Legislation alone can't do it. We've all got to play our part somehow. And I really believe that slavery is one of those that we can all play our part in trying to get rid of. And of course, traffickers play on the most vulnerable in society. Women and children issues, another big issue around the world, is child marriage. And I've done quite a bit on this. I'm quite passionate about it. There are quite a number of countries that have incredibly high rates of child marriage, i.e. children married under the age of 18. The rankings are mostly India, Bangladesh, and then an awful lot of African countries. And I made a film in Nigeria about it some years ago. And There's the majority of children. So Nigeria is a really interesting country. It's predominantly Christian in the south and predominantly very conservative Islamic in the north. And the north has a very high rate of child marriage. The average age of children getting married is 12, 13, 14. So in its own right, kind of you can debate whether you agree with that or not. The issue is that when they come to have children, they may conceive, but their little bodies really aren't ready to deliver children. And the Nigerian government tried to introduce a Child Marriage Act in 2003, but the way that Nigeria works is each state is allowed to amend legislation appropriate to its particular traditions and culture. So when we were there, only one state in the whole of northern Nigeria had adopted the act, compared with a whole bunch of states in the south. And the divide in Nigeria is very obvious. We arrived, we were allocated this incredibly difficult place to work in and film in. We were allocated a minder who was from the Christian south. She'd come up from Lagos. She was quite buxom. She wore very low-cut tops. And she sat in the back of our minibus singing Jesus Loves You in the middle of Ramadan when we're filming in a very conservative area, which now is no-go. It's Boko Haram zone. We were very lucky at the time we got away with filming up there. We had more conflict in the minibus than we had anywhere else. That was quite interesting. But, sorry, I'm a bit behind on the slides. Here we go. But the big issue, as I said, is actually that young children, if you give birth under 15, you're 5 times more likely to die in childbirth. And Nigeria's got the highest maternal mortality rate in Africa. A third of the girls dying are adolescent. Just have a look at this. Oh, actually, before we go, has anyone heard of the condition fistula? Are you aware of it? Yeah, we've pretty much got rid of it here because we don't have children. The clip will explain it, but fistula is a condition. If children give birth too young, basically it's horrific tearing, and it leaves mostly the girls incontinent for life, and the majority do lose their babies as well. Ta-da! Look at that, by magic. Let's try again.
Most cases of fistula happen to young girls during their first pregnancy. Dr. Case told me that nearly half of his patients are under 16 years old.
How many patients do you have at the moment?
At the moment, I think something like 150, 200 patients.
Right. How serious is this problem?
I think it's a very serious problem, specifically socially. See, since they marry young, they get pregnant and they deliver young and they pick up the fistula. And then for most of them, if you don't go for treatment, their life has ended already before it has had a chance to start. If nothing is done, the woman ends up crippled for life. Medically, socially, mentally, and emotionally.
As the women are left incontinent, the smell of urine is overpowering, and girls are shunned by their friends and family. In 95% of cases, the woman will lose the baby too. Dr. Case said there are 25,000 new cases of fistula every year, and that the numbers are on the increase.
Dr. Case has just shown me the files of this lady here.
This young lady.
She's so young. Salaam alaikum. And Dr. Case says that this lady, and it says here, inoperable. Sulay, what happened to you?
Sulay Swejo told me she got married when she was 12 years old, and she had her first baby when she was 15. She has had fistula twice and may be incontinent for life.
She just has recounted all of her pregnancies. She's had 6 and she's lost all 6 babies. What's it like having fistula?
Zulay told me she was in constant pain. Zulay
says that she exhales really bad, having fistula, and she says, I'm leaking urine. I'm the only one who's leaking urine.
So we went into villages and we gathered all the men in the village and we said, how many of you have lost wives, daughters, sisters in childbirth? Over half of them put their hands up. And we said, there was an 84-year-old man there who'd married a 14-year-old 2 years ago. And we spoke to him and we said, really? And he said, well, it's much better for them to be married young so they don't have sex out of marriage. And we said, are you aware of the Child Marriage Act that the government is trying to introduce to try and stop this happening to young girls? And he said, well, yes, but, you know, government can do what it likes. We'll continue to do our traditions and culture, thanks very much. And in remote villages, who's going to police it? Again, with all of these issues, it's all about shifting attitudes and shifting people's worldviews. Legislation helps, and it's great, and we can try and enforce it, but so many things are about changing mindsets. And that's what we really try and do, particularly as investigative journalists and storytellers. We're trying to inform and shift a mindset, because that's what creates a change somehow. I'm going to move on to a slightly different. I'm really sorry. I don't want to leave you all depressed, and I promise I won't. I'm going to motor on quite quickly into war. I promise I won't leave you depressed. And these are sorry. I'm a bit slow on the uptake. These are all the girls. Some of the girls that we met. If some of you saw the promo videos, I feel very passionately that issues are not just things that organisations deal with. They're people. They're these girls, you know. There's somebody's daughter. There's somebody's sister. All of these things are people who have a story. That's Ramita and I filming. Ramita and I have made lots of films. I don't know if anyone knows her. She's a brilliant, brilliant journalist. We've trotted off together to all sorts of places. And the brilliant thing about being two ladies is that people just don't really expect you to be kind of, I don't know, pushy journalists. So you get away with all sorts of stuff because they think you're just two sweet, kind of nice girls, middle-class English accents. And so we end up getting the most extraordinary interviews because people don't really think about what they're saying to us. War. People are always fascinated by the work I've done in Afghanistan. And I've spent quite a lot of time there. I've done a few films there. The first time I went out to Afghanistan was in 2006. And in those days, I went from Brize Norton, and you had to fly into Kandahar directly because there was nothing into Camp Bastion. There were two of us making a long-form observational documentary about a two-month Chinook pilots, a unit of Chinook pilots there. And we flew off, and I was surrounded by a bunch of young chaps. There was a 19-year-old chap next to me. He was and all revved up. And the way that they landed into Kandahar in those days is you put on your full body armour. So you're sitting in a little plane seat with 10 kilos worth, pretty much, of flat jacket and helmet. They turn all the lights off and they descend at an extraordinarily rapid rate because, you know, a plane for the Taliban was a lovely target, thanks very much, with fresh troops coming in. So that's how they land. And this lovely boy, 19-year-old, next to me, who had been full of bravado, he was going on tour, gripped my hand in the darkness. And as the lights came on, he flushed red, terribly embarrassed, and took his hand away. I was like, "That's all right, you'll be okay." But that was my introduction into Afghanistan, into Kandahar. But Afghanistan, for journalists, was an extraordinary place because, you know, the campaign was 13 years long. We had to engage audiences for 13 years. And over that time, there was a lot more political apathy, more people were coming home in body bags, a lot of money was being spent. It was not politically sound anymore for us to be there. The British public didn't want our forces there anymore. They couldn't really see the reasons for it anymore. That was a general feeling as the years went on. So we as filmmakers and storytellers had to be really creative in terms of finding new ways to engage audiences. This film, that first film was really fun. Literally, I then got on a Chinook helicopter and flew out to Camp Bastion. This is Bastion in those days. And completely on my own, I had my full body armour, my rucksack with my personal kit, my camera in hand. And again, at that point, there was nothing there. So you land, a Chinook again is a nice target. You land in the dark, all that they've just got very low level lighting, and it casts a little light swell out of the back. And you jump out and you go off and get in a Land Rover. Well, I didn't know where I was going. You've got earplugs in. They don't turn the rotors off because they land and get out really fast. And you've got ballistics, is filming in the helicopters. You've got ballistic goggles on. You can't hear anything. You can't see anything. You don't know where you're going. So I grabbed the rucksack of the chap in front of me. Bad mistake. He was 6'4". And the drop off the end of the helicopter is enormous if you've got really short legs. You're loaded down. And followed him, got in the Land Rover, got into Camp Bastion, and I literally had a hand-drawn map on a piece of paper of the tents and a name. And I was walking around Camp Bastion with all my kit in the dark, going, excuse me, could you tell me where Major so-and-so is, please? And I eventually found my tent. The last film I made was, I think it was 2010, this is the MERT flights. They were doing pickups of all the injured soldiers. We followed them on all of it. The last film that I made in about, I think it was 2010, we took an international flight from Brize-Norton straight into Bastion onto one of their two major international runways, so one of the busiest airports in the world, and Camp Bastion was the size of Reading. That's how much, you know, there was such an influx of resources and just how the war, or the campaign, technically, progressed over time. So it's a hugely challenging way to make films. I did two embeds with the British military. One was this helicopter film, which was great fun. I literally had free rein. I had no minders, nothing. I would just wander out, rig up all the cameras on the helicopters, sit in there, watch them come in and out, potter off. I lived in with the guys. Oh, a tent full of blokes, really smelly. In camp cots. And the emergency phone was right next to my camp cot, so when it rang in the night, there was no way I was going to miss the shout. It was a really extraordinary experience following that, and we had some great challenges making this, but it was fascinating being part of that. So in 2010, I went back and made a film about reservists and the different jobs they were doing there, and again spent a couple of months doing that. Which was also interesting. But I also made a film right up in the north in Afghanistan, in Badakhshan, where they've got the highest maternal mortality rate in the world. And I'll skirt over that because I'm running out of time already. So I was very lucky. I got a huge range of experience of both local issues as well as kind of the military stuff. But it was a very challenging place to work in. But ironically, everyone always goes, wasn't that really dangerous? Well, no, I had the entire British Army looking after me. And, you know, if something was going to happen, there's a medic right there, and there's facilities. And these guys, you know, Chinook takes half an hour normally to do pre-flight checks. My goodness, they are amazing. Those pilots get in, and they've got it up in the air in 11 minutes to get out to soldiers. And they will fly into ongoing firefights, pick up injured soldiers. And they always travel with an Apache attack helicopter, which is their defence with them. But if someone's really severely injured and the onboard docs say, get them back as fast as possible, the Chinook can outfly the Apache. So they will leave their defences behind and get back to the hospital. At the height of the campaign, Camp Bastion Hospital was the busiest trauma hospital in the world. It was the most cutting edge there was. The medicine that has been learnt there is extraordinary. And if you got back to Bastion alive, you had a 99% survival rate by the end of the campaign. Really extraordinary developments in medicine and fascinating to be part of and watch. I spent a lot of time in the hospital filming particular characters there, and quite gruesome, but really fascinating, really fascinating. And a huge privilege to be part of that. But other places that have conflict are much more challenging to work in. And there are many parts of the world that have ongoing problems and conflict. South Sudan is somewhere I'm really passionate about. I worked there many years ago, and sadly, it's just been a perpetual cycle of the same stuff. They had a new peace agreement at the end of last year. It's the same political players, There's not much hope of it, actually, sadly. People are kind of not really hopeful that it's not going to descend into crisis again. The world's not really interested, because that was old news when it was going to be the newest country in the world and it got independence from the north. There's lots of evidence of Khartoum fueling conflicts still over resources. It's always traditionally had tribal arguments over cattle and land and what have you. But South Sudan is somewhere that has moved me more than anywhere, I think. Ramita, who you saw in the other film, she and I spent quite some time here, just the two of us on our own, trotting around South Sudan, which was an immensely challenging place to work. It's the size of France, and it's got 50 kilometres of paved roads. You know, you're taking boats and planes and UN flights, which are terribly annoying because they've got only a 15-kilo weight limit, and my stripped-down kit's 100 kilos. So, logistically, lots of challenges. But it was indicative of a lot of places in the world where this continual cycle of famine and refugees, these are little ones who are riddled with infections because they're so malnourished, they tube feed them, women who have nothing to eat but literally grass. And we waited for a World Food Programme helicopter to come in and deliver aid, and the aid came, but the tribal elders hadn't arrived. So these women who were starving and these children who were starving had to wait 3 days for a tribal elder to turn up so they could distribute it. It's a very hard system to fathom. But a really fascinating place. But what I actually want to tell you about here is the impact on, again, children. So, and I promise I won't leave you completely miserable. But the impact on children.
We'd heard accounts of children being kidnapped during raids. Child abduction has always happened during cattle rustling here, but the numbers have increased significantly. We travelled to Bor, the capital of Jonglei State, to visit a home for children who'd been recently rescued from their captors.
I'm going to meet the director of child welfare. He's been helping look after the kids in this temporary shelter.
These 13 children were stolen 4 months ago from different tribes, but they were all rescued from the same village after a tip-off. Paul Okwie Ojulo said the authorities are still trying to find their parents.
Why were these children abducted?
They just abduct children, then they sell it among themselves.
And how much are children worth?
Sometimes 30 head of cattle, or sometimes 25.
How many children like this do you think are abducted every year?
Where there is tribal conflict, the number of abducted children increases.
Can you tell me about some of their individual cases? What happened to this boy here, for example?
Twelve-year-old Umot was fishing with his parents when they were ambushed. He watched as his mother and three friends were killed by members of the Merlay tribe before he was snatched.
All of these children were taken when their families, their villages were attacked. And they don't even know if these children's parents are still alive.
Over 200 children have been abducted so far this year from Jonglei State alone. Nobody knows what the figure is for the entire country.
You see, so what I like to do stories about is the stuff that's kind of unreported. Lots of people know about South Sudan and its politics and the conflict, but they don't know an awful lot about the impact. Predominantly in conflict, it's the women and children who suffer the most impact. But in terms of peace and reconciliation, it's the women who actually do the work. Particularly in Africa. They're the ones who hold the communities together and move forward. South Sudan was I could tell you for hours about that. It was a fascinating place to work in. It was also really dangerous. Actually, quite a few of them have been. I've been shot at, rocketed, mortared, had a whole bunch of things go on. And people say to me, why do you do that? How on earth do you want to do that? Well, to make these kind of films, you kind of have to have a lot of tenacity. You have to be fit, you have to be strong, you have to be creative in lots of ways. You have to learn how to mend your camera when there's no other way to do it because the dust has given up or the humidity. You have to be really resourceful. But if you care enough about something you're doing, actually you find that way. And we all have very different perceptions of risk. We're all different. We're all made differently. So I'm terrified of cows. I will not walk through a field of cows. Everyone thinks I'm ridiculous, but frankly, they're large, they run at you, and you can't negotiate with them. I'm not going there. But I'm not afraid of kind of bombs and bullets. And risk actually isn't all about bombs and bullets. In northern Afghanistan, when we were filming up there, there was a massive earthquake, and we all came downstairs, but it was more dangerous for us to go outside because the kidnap risk was so high in the dark, so we all stood under a pillar downstairs going, when's the earthquake going to stop? Are we okay? Are we going to get crushed or kidnapped? What do we do? We decided to get crushed because it's much nastier to get kidnapped. And as journalists, actually, over the last 10, 15 years, risk has changed immensely for us. So it's blindingly obvious. Actually, all the people that you're filming with, all your contributors, they're taking risk all the time. We're not unusual. We're not special because we choose to do risky stuff, actually. These people live with it. But having said that, as journalists, NGOs, charities, aid workers have become much more targets than we ever were. We used to be independent observers, and we're not anymore. We are worth something. You never want to be Italian or French because the governments will pay for you, so you're a great kidnap target. But you know what? They don't ask you if you're British before they kidnapped you. I'm British. My government won't pay for me. Please leave me alone. and this constantly changes, and you know, at a time when we're working. But there's lots of different ways of doing risk. And you also... you have to be happy to kind of live in all sorts of strange conditions. I made a film in the DRC in Congo. We spent 6 weeks with park rangers who were trying to save the furry gorillas, the mountain gorillas, from the non-furry gorillas, the rebels. And they were getting massacred through the conflict because they were feeding their troops with, estimated to be only 25 gorillas left at the time that we were filming there. And we spent 6 weeks with these rangers. And I was the only female, so obviously couldn't. When they went to wash in the river, I obviously couldn't go with them. And we were staying in a village one day, and the ladies came, and they kind of knocked on my tent. Can't think of what else. And bless them, they'd rigged up a little tarpaulin round a tree and hung a bucket so I could wash my hair. And it was so lovely. And I got in there, and I turned the bucket. I was like, ah. Oh. And then I heard a little giggle, and I heard some chatter, and I looked up, and the trees all around me were filled with little boys who had come from the village because they'd seen the bucket go up, and they thought that was brilliant. But you know what? The shower was so nice. Well, I'll let them have their entertainment. And so they all ran home going, we saw a naked white woman. And that was really exciting for them. And you have to get used to eating chicken bone curry and chicken and chips an awful lot and pretty disgusting things along the way too. But you know what? It's all part of the experience. It's all part of the fun. You have to love culture and life and flavours and smells of all sorts and not really mind it. Obviously, I've done a lot of training. I'm legally not allowed to. I'm not insured if I'm not. Countries around the world are all categorised. I'm hostile environment trained, which is a five-day course. They put you through the lot. You know, you do full kidnap, stress positions a lot. And there's a very high percentage of people who think they want to work in hostile environments who do the course and go, you know what, this actually isn't for me. I had a romanticised idea of going to make these kind of films, but I don't really to be in this position for real. So it's quite a good way. And that's something that gets regularly refreshed, and it's predominantly about first aid and safety. So if you get shot tonight, I can help you out. If you've got a cold, I really can't. I haven't got a clue. But we do, it's actually all about the greatest risk to people working in places like this is actually road traffic accidents. It's really simple stuff. It's eating dodgy things. It's eating things that aren't agreeing with you. It's malaria. And then you've got to get out. Are we okay for 5 more minutes? Really quick story. When I was working with Stacey in Ivory Coast, she got malaria, and we had a medical evacuation planned, and all the other crew drove back to the capital and got a nice BA flight home, and our medical evacuation plane just didn't turn up. And at midnight, I had a phone call to say, get to the airstrip in 5 minutes. Now, we were somewhere really, really remote. There are no lights. The airstrip is a grass strip. There's nothing there. And they had said they'd provide transport to the airstrip. And they said, you've got 15 minutes. That plane's going to land. And I said, well, is someone picking us up? No. Thankfully, we'd made friends with a cook who had a car at the hotel we were staying in. So we jumped in and we bumped down this road. And Stacey was really unwell. And if anyone has an experience of Africa, they'll know that bumping down in the dark onto a grass airstrip that's not lit up is not really ideal in somewhere that's not having a particularly nice time of conflict. And we arrived at this airstrip, and there was a little concrete hut and a man sitting there with a big rotund belly with sweat dripping down it and his AK-47 across him and a bare light bulb and flies buzzing. I was like, oh, gosh, no lights. We said, there's a plane about to land. And by that point, it was landing in approximately 6 minutes. No. We've all gone to bed for the night, so no, you really need to put the landing lights on. No. Anyway, eventually we convinced somebody to get a motorbike up the hill to the chap. And this is all in French, which I don't speak terribly well. And poor Stacey turned around to me and said, are we going to be raped and murdered? I was like, no, we'll be fine. Thinking, oh, heavens, our first film. It's not great. And so I was literally running up and down the airstrip going, turn the lights on. And I saw that, because there's no light pollution, I saw the plane come in. And I know it will circle three times. If it can't see the landing strip, it'll go. It circled once, twice, three times, it started flying out. And I was like, oh, now what do we do? And all the time, men were appearing out of the dark with AK-47s strung over them. And I was thinking, oh, this is not great. And the lights flickered on. I said, they're going, the lights, please. The plane circle came back and picked us up. What had happened was earlier that day, three rebels had been flown out of the country against the government's wishes, so they shut down all air traffic. They can do that in Africa. They shut down all air traffic, including medical evacuations. So our flight had flown over from Ghana, had been flying all afternoon trying to get permission to land. They were given a 15-minute window. And the pilot said, I'd given up, I was flying out, but something... He said it was like a physical tap on his shoulder made him turn around. And it was only in turning around he saw the lights flicker on, which if he hadn't turned back, he wouldn't have seen because he was already heading out. Thank you. We got out. And we flew, and they checked over in Ghana, and we flew first class. I've never flown first class back, BA, and I drank all of Stacey's champagne for her on the way. But, you know, people who work in this industry, never let them tell you that they're not fearful of it in some way. Fear's healthy. There's a good reason why we feel it. If you work with anybody in this area that isn't a little bit afraid, well, then they're not utilising their wits about them properly. And you really learn to rely on your guts and your instincts, because actually, at the end of the day, that'll really tell you when you're in trouble or not. So, why do we do it? Well, it's all about the impact. Go back and remember Katrina at the beginning of the talk? The impact of that film was the federal government transferred a whole load of... They were so embarrassed by it, they transferred a whole load of funds and down into Louisiana and tried to sort out the criminal justice system. It has a long way to go still, and it's still a mess. But it caused them to have a look, and they reviewed who was in. There was a woman in the prison who had been released on paper, but nobody had physically walked down the corridor and let her out. If Katrina hadn't happened, she had been saying every day to the guards, I'm not meant to be here. And they'd go, yeah, you and everyone else, love. If Katrina hadn't happened, she would still be locked up. Nigeria, quite a lot of the films that I've made I've shown in Parliament to select groups. They formed a group there. They lobbied the Nigerian government on it. There's still ongoing issues with it. Obviously, it's politically very sensitive, but there's a new initiative that's come out, and the Nigerian government are trying very hard to get everyone to sign up to the Child Marriage Act. Where else I'm trying to think about along the way? There's lots of different places that have actually had an impact, and that's why we do it. So, Syria. I made a film about torture in Syria, which was pretty horrific. But it was the first film that had ever brought together a body of evidence, which seems extraordinary now in the hindsight of what has happened over the years. But it was right at the beginning when problems started happening in Syria. We made it as a body of evidence. I actually naively at that time thinking al-Assad would go to a criminal court. And we took that to Parliament, and they formed an all-parliamentary group on Syria, and for the first time ever recognised that torture was systematic in Syria. So the films that we make, if you do something with them, it's all very well they go out, but you've then got to do something with them and push and advocate and raise awareness with them, basically. And then you see what happens. And it's a bit like ripples on the pond. You never really know what's going to happen. And sometimes the impact may be negative. I don't know. I just have to trust that somewhere something good comes of it somehow. And what we're really trying to do in storytelling with an audience is create a good storytelling and crafting. When you're watching it and you're properly engaged, people will shift from watching something with their head to their heart and their gut. When you craft something well enough that people start watching with their heart and engage properly, that's when change happens. That's when people sign up to doing things about it. So that's what we're really trying to do. But we just, a little warning, we have to be really aware of our attitudes and the way we portray places. There is a general tendency in the Western world to look down on those poor people in Africa, in India, in Asia, wherever, because they are poor in material stuff. But you know what? I really learned they are so rich in so much else that we don't have. No one over there is going to die lonely in their flat and not be discovered for a couple of months because they look after their families. They are not lonely. You can strip everything from someone. You can take their home, you can take their family, you can take their freedom, you can strip the clothes off their back, but you can never, ever take someone's story from them. It's the most precious thing we all have, which is what makes this job such a responsibility but a huge privilege. And we have to be so aware of how we portray what we're portraying. And that's enormously challenging in a very short, you know, television airtime to try and distill an awful lot of information and be fair, accurate, impartial, but representative of someone's heart and their story. Can I read you something very, very quickly? In Africa, if you ask somebody how they are, they say, we are fine or we are not fine. And the person you're asking may be absolutely fine, but if their mother or a family member isn't fine, then collectively they are not. They have a thing called Ubuntu, which is it's just a cultural thing that it works. This is my favourite, one of my favourite books, Desmond Tutu, God Has a Dream. And he sums it up beautifully. He says, the first law of our being is that we are set in a delicate network of interdependence with our fellow human beings and with the rest of God's creation. In Africa, recognition of our independence is called Ubuntu. It is the essence of being human. It speaks of the fact that my humanity is caught up and inextricably bound up in yours. I am human because I belong. It speaks about wholeness. It speaks about compassion. And a person with Ubuntu is welcoming, hospitable, warm and generous, willing to share. Such people are open and available to others. Willing to be vulnerable, affirming of others, do not feel threatened that others are able and good, for they have proper self-assurance that comes from knowing they belong in a greater whole. They know that when they are diminished when others are humiliated, diminished when others are oppressed, diminished when others are treated as if they were less than who they are. The quality of Ubuntu gives people resilience, enabling them to survive and emerge still human despite all efforts to dehumanise them. For me, that sums up what we're trying to achieve in creating the head-to-heart shift and to get people to engage with stuff. And the people who are absolutely nothing, in my experience, the people who ate a handful of corn put a handful aside for us. They have nothing, but what they have is relationship. And sometimes just listening to someone's story and being heard is enough to feel that you are loved. And if you feel loved, you have hope. If you have hope, you can have nothing else, but you have reason to be. So very quickly, where's kind of God in all of this? I think they are richer quite often in relationship than we are in societies that are rich in material stuff. They have nothing, and I'm not saying that it's ideal to have poverty and all sorts of horrific stuff going on. However, someone quoted this passage to me once in Matthew, where he says, there's no chance at all if you think you can pull it off yourself. Every chance in the world if you trust God to do it. Time and time again, in places where I have nothing, people have absolutely nothing. They've been stripped of dignity, of freedom, of everything. They have such a strong sense of relationship. And those who are in Christian countries have such a strong faith that gives them hope. And that's really affirming. I've been a Christian for nearly 30 years, and my goodness, I've wrestled with it. And a lot of films, and when you're absolutely exhausted, you're like, seriously, where are you? What is going on? Why are you not helping here? And I don't get it. And I think God's heart breaks every time. He goes, I gave you choice and I gave you free will and look what you're doing with it. It's your choice to behave like that as human beings. And I think his heart breaks. If you're Christian, you believe that actually the battle against death is won already. However, right now, we're waiting for Jesus to come back, if you believe that. If you don't, we are capable of making change for all of these kinds of things. And I think God really needs us to be his hands, his feet, his ears, his heart. He needs us to stand up and play our part. And it doesn't matter what your part is. It doesn't matter what your skill set is. It can be simply sharing stories and educating your children that they're jolly lucky where they are and making them aware. And I go back to the stone on the pond ripple effect. You never know what a quiet word will do. And for these people, they are predominantly just so grateful to be heard, because it's an indication of, oh, we've given up before the last grade. That's telling me to stop. And I just want to leave you with one last thing. Does anyone know Mary Colvin? Heard of her? She was an incredible war reporter. She was killed in Syria, targeted by the Syrian government. She did a lot of work at Channel 4. She was one of our gang. When she died, the cameraman who was with her, Paul, actually came and worked with me in Parliament when we were lobbying on the Syrian torture stuff. And he was standing behind her when they killed her. And he said the words to the effect of, and I wrote it down, I was so touched by it. Hang on. Skip to the last page. He said, despite everything she had seen and been through, she kept a kind of innocence. Time and bitter experience never rubbed away that childlike quality. She was always able to find wonder in things. And I have huge respect for that. The amount that she had done, and she stayed. She always stayed because she believed she'd make a difference by staying when everyone else left. And when she died, her mother said of her, her legacy was to be passionate and be involved in what you believe in, and do it as thoroughly and honestly and fearlessly as you can. I believe that's quite a good thing to aspire to. And I believe it's a good thing to aspire to, whether you are looking after kids in church, whether you're giving someone a lift home tonight because it's blooming miserable out there, whether you are simply listening to somebody who's a bit lonely, whether you make someone a cup of tea. It doesn't matter what you do. We're all different. We all have different skill sets. It's up to us to do it how you like. But I think that's quite a good way to live. Well, however you choose to do it. I'm really sorry if I've made you a bit all depressed. I think there's more wine. But I hope that maybe you'll go away and having learnt a little bit more about some of the kind of more untold things there are out in the world. And empowered a little and inspired a little that you can all play a part, you know, in helping change life for somebody somewhere.
I'm conscious Julie's given out a huge amount, but she did say she would be happy to take a few questions. So we probably haven't got too long, just maybe about 5 minutes, and then we'll kind of wrap up. Are there questions for Julie?
I just wanted to know what you're working on at the moment, and has your move north been a problem for your career?
Actually, I didn't read the small print of the marriage contract when I married into the military. Ridiculous. I should have known a lot better, having spent a lot of time with them. Joe mentioned my husband works at Headley Court. He's the head of, which is now Stamford Hall, which is why we moved away. He works in complex trauma. He heads up complex trauma there. So he works with all the severely, the double, triple amputees. Actually, ironically, the first film I made in Afghanistan was not long after we'd met. And when we got married, the longest time we'd both spent in the same place was actually Camp Bastion. And I didn't tell you, actually, when I was making that film, my colleague got shot. And I was filming in the hospital when it happened. And the lead surgeon was beside me. And as the information came in, it said civilian on it. So there were 5 guys coming in as category A's, which means they've had tourniquets put on, which means it's severe life-threatening injury. And then it came up civilian. Longest 7 minutes of my life waiting for this helicopter to land to see if John was okay. And he came out the back of an ambulance with his camera like this. And he opened half an eye and he went, Jules? I said, yeah. He said, have you got the camera? I said, yeah. And he passed out. And he was absolutely fine. He'd been shot through the knee and long-term rehabilitation. He was fine. And he left. What's lovely about that is we have a common, we have an understanding of each other's jobs, but unfortunately, having had children, I've ended up following his job when we've moved quite, well, we've moved three times in the last 3 years, and we're due to move again in 3 months, which is slightly, and I've also, my kids are 2 and 5, and that's changed a lot. Frankly, it's exhausting. Technically, I'm called a geriatric mother in these days. Yeah, kids over 40. And I sometimes think, oh, put me back in Afghanistan. It was quieter than two small boys. So at the moment, I teach on master's journalism courses. I teach how to do foreign affairs reporting. I'm doing talks. I'm doing a lot of advocacy work. I'm working with a bunch of different organisations, trustee on a few organisations, working in fields and places where I've worked. And I'm writing a book as well. So I consult on projects and I'm doing bits and pieces, but this little season in life, my children are too little for me to disappear and my husband's not around enough. So that's where I am at the moment. But we'll see what the next chapter comes along the way.
Have you ever been...
Oh.
Have you ever been reporting or investigating and find you just can't sleep at night because it's constantly on your mind?
Yeah, you do. Could you all hear that?
I'll try again. Have you ever been investigating something which doesn't enable you to sleep at night because of the concerns?
Yeah, absolutely.
You feel it in your heart as well.
Yeah, you do. The journalists are a bit like surgeons and doctors. We have a bit of a black humour. It's the way we get through it. When you're working in the field, it's particularly as a self-shooting producer-director, which I've shot most of those films, as well as producing and directing them. Your brain is so absorbed with so much. You're filming, you're thinking, you're editing in your head, you're checking out the right questions, you're watching your surroundings because you don't know where danger's coming from, you know where your X route is. Is your reporter okay? Is the contributor okay? Have I got the sound levels right? Is the light changing? There's so much going on that you focus on the technical of doing the story. And the shoots are, you know, an unreported... Has anyone watched Unreported World? It's Channel 4's name. We have 16 days to make those films on location. They're really, really brutal. You don't have time to really take on board the emotion of what you're doing when you're working. And actually, you know what? You wouldn't be very good at your job if you got crippled by it. So you do lose sleep, but you tend to lose more sleep over the technicalities of, am I doing my job properly? Because if I'm not, then actually I'm pretty useless and I'm not going to help these people anyway. It tends to be in the edit when you've done the rough cut and the commissioner comes in to watch it for the first time and the lawyer, and you sit at the back and for the first time you're not watching it tweaking stuff and you watch it as a film and you go, oh, that's a bit miserable. And that's when it tends to sink in more. And there is a danger, particularly being freelance, you go project to project, there is a danger of not actually absorbing and taking on board the people's stories, and they do impact, you know. Each of them, you give a little piece of your heart and you take a little piece of their heart somehow. You bond and you connect with people. And I very much, interestingly, becoming a mother has changed that an awful lot. There's a lot of people who, I never thought I'd feel this, but a lot of people who haunt me now. And I think, I wonder if she, you know, the young woman I met crossing the desert, in the Sonoran Desert, trying to find a better life for her two-year-old she'd left in Mexico, crossing up into Arizona, into America. We did a whole film about that 10 years ago, and the issues have not changed. And let me tell you, I don't agree with the wall. They will always find their way, and more people will just die if you stick a bigger wall up. It was an issue 10 years ago. She haunts me, and I think she had a little two-year-old, and she was tiny, and she was about to do a three-day trip across the desert. She promised to get in touch, and I never heard from her. And I, you know, people like her, I think, what happened? Did she ever see her child again? And I think of my two-year-old, and I think, God, I couldn't do that. And I've processed a lot more of the films I've made since I've had children, interestingly, and I've had time to. And you have to put stuff in place. You know, you've got to have good girlfriends you can have a big bottle of wine with and chat with about it and sort of get it all out. Otherwise, you're no good at going on and doing the next story, really. But yeah, you do lose sleep, and particularly when you're sleeping in huts and wondering if you're going to get cattle raided next. You know, lots of expensive kit they'd quite like, thank you very much. But yeah, you do. Not as much as when I've got kids who keep me up all night, 5 years in a row. At least when you come home from a shoot, you have a bacon sandwich, a hot cup of tea, a large bath, and you go to sleep for 3 days. It's in uninterrupted sleep. That's marvellous. There's an end in sight. Not so with small people. But.
Maybe one more question.
Anyone?
Yes. So with this kind of challenging job, how do you look after yourself? How do you keep fit physically and mentally?
So when I was doing this stuff full-time, actually when I was working in news, I had a case packed under my bag and I kept called to say there's a flight in 2 hours leaving from Heathrow, can you get on it? And at the height of when I was doing most of this stuff and spending most of my time in the field, I was physically very, very fit and strong. Any film you make, the first thing you do is you go, am I the right person to make this film? And that is mentally, physically and emotionally, am I in the right place to make the film? Because if you're not, you're not going to do it any justice and you're not actually going to achieve what you're trying to do. There's no point. And so I was very, very physically fit and strong. I was healthy. You know, all my immunisations are always fully up to date. All my training was up to date. And you're very much in a mode of going and keeping going. And there's it's a very small community, those who work in investigative journalism, hostile environment work. We all know each other pretty much. Interestingly, people assume it's mostly men. There's a very high proportion of women. They're predominantly behind the camera, not in front of it. There's an awful lot of good female producer directors who are self-shooting and crafting that are, you know, the public have this sense that there's a handful of iconic women. We were talking earlier, you know, there's a handful of iconic women that people know, Orla Galain and Abby, but actually behind that, there's an awful lot of really interesting women who are producing, directing and shooting. And so there's a nice community of actually we keep each other healthy by downloading, and frankly it does involve a lot of wine and a good chat. And, you know, every now and again you need a good cry and you just need to get it out. When the minute you're not healthy or you're having repercussions, then you're not doing your job properly, you're not doing what you're aiming to do. So you need to kind of take some time out and reassess. And everyone does that differently. Everyone does that differently. And there's a big thing in this of you, when you work in risky places, the biggest thing of all, you must know your own limits and boundaries. You need to know yourself really well. You need to know your threshold of risk, whatever that is. And everyone's is different. And every organisation you work with is different. So if you work with the UN, they'll come home when everything starts hitting the fan. Médecins Sans Frontières, they're out on the front line. I'm going with them. But if you understand the thresholds of risk that is different, and you can only work to the capacity of the person on your team's lowest threshold of risk. Otherwise, you're putting everyone in danger, and it's your responsibility. You sign the risk assessment, you're responsible for everybody, including your contributors. And the risk you put them in. So you have to know yourself and your team incredibly well. You have to know what your limits are. And we're all different. You know, we're individual. We're born with characters and things. I think we're enormously influenced by our upbringings, by our experiences, things that feed into us. I grew up in Africa. I know it very well. So that's predominantly been my field of work. But I've worked and lived and played in well over 60 countries, so I've had a lot of experience elsewhere. But I know when I've hit time to stop, and I know the warning signs. So I think you have to be very realistic, and when you hit your threshold, you go, okay, because actually someone gets hurt, and it's not necessarily you when you hit that. But we're all shaped very differently, and different influences play into our lives. So like I said, I was born in Africa. I didn't have the easiest upbringing. It gave me huge independence and huge ability to be fairly robust. There's a lot of good that comes out of adversity. I really believe that. There is always good that comes out of adversity, whatever that is. And it's different for everybody. Different for everybody. And we've all got different perceptions of risk, and we're willing to put ourselves through different things. Like I said, I'm sure most of you would probably walk through a field of cows. I'm not getting there. and aside from that is... one of the big things we learn in this industry is never, ever judge anybody. You never know what has formed and shaped someone's character, personality, heart, Never. And you know what, actually the hardest thing to do that with, and it goes most importantly for, are the perpetrators of stuff. I don't believe that anyone is born evil. You know, I believe if we are created in the image of God, God didn't intend us to be born to treat other humans in that way. And I think it's, you know, we have a self-perpetuating humanity where we make choices that just pass down through generation after generation. I spent so much time in prisons where daddy went to prison, son went to prison. Oh, in Gola, they had three generations worth of guys all in prison because they learnt and they learnt and I learnt. And the cycles are so hard to break of pain and despair. And my experience is genuinely someone who is so dehumanised that they can treat another human being that way has been treated that way themselves in some way. And it's incredibly hard to do because it's very easy to judge, you know, rogue politicians through to traffickers, through to murderers and rapists. But everyone is shaped in a different way. And at some point, they were an innocent little baby. They didn't start out with that. And which is why we need to change our worldviews and our attitudes to change the stuff that doesn't work and creates pain and hurts humanity. It's up to all of us to change our attitude. And I think one of the biggest things is you really learn never judge a book by its cover. Never, ever. I remember taking Oliver when he was born swimming lessons, and the lady in the swimming lessons, I said, my name's Julie and this is Oliver, when we met her, and she went, I don't need to know your name, you're just Oliver's mum. And you know what, that's really always stuck with me. I was so cross. So cross. So I was like, just Oliver's mum. And that for me was a real lesson of not assuming someone is just someone's granny, or someone's uncle, or you know, whoever. Everyone has a story, and everyone's story is different. And until you really know a little bit more about them, you can never judge why people do what they do.
Julie, I think we could listen to you all night, but I'm conscious we probably ought to wrap up. But I think if you're happy to sort of hang around a little bit, if people want to chat. Thank you so much. Little did I know when I first met Julie at church or in my driveway, and those of you who knew Julie through being Oliver and Sam's mum, you know, it's incredible. And I do wish we had longer, but it's been fantastic to hear about your experiences. I found it personally very moving and inspiring. And just thank you so much, particularly when I know you're not feeling that great. So
it's all good.
Thank you ever, ever so much. And I hope perhaps in the future we might have the opportunity to hear more and to watch. So are any of your films on kind of iPlayer or things like that?
They're a lot of them on YouTube. They're mostly all available. You can Google if you caught any of those titles. You can Google. If there are any interesting ones you want to watch, then ask me and I'll tell you where to find them. But yeah, there's a bunch out there. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you. Like I said, we all like to be heard, don't we? We all love a story.
Thank you for just listening. Just as we have a very little, this is a little piece of Surrey.
Thank you.
We're also giving Julie an honorarium, which she is donating to a charity. Do you want to just say very briefly what the charity, it's someone you, through someone you've met up where you're currently living?
There's a lovely lady who I met where I'm living who used to live in India, and she set up a, she now lives in Leicestershire, but she set up a charity for slum kids. excuse me, the cough has held out all the way. We're doing okay. It's time for wine, clearly, for everybody. But she's travelling out there on the 1st of March and wants to take a whole bunch of educational supplies. So tonight we'll fund, excuse me, we'll fund her being able to actually choose and select stuff that's appropriate rather than kind of taking donations, which are obviously very welcome, but she can target exactly what she needs to take out. So she's off at the end of this month to do that. So hopefully that will help. So thank you for all coming, because otherwise they wouldn't benefit from it too.
Julie, thank you ever so much. Let's say thank you. Just as we finish, just to flag up the two next Tonic events. They're a little way away, but to give you plenty of notice. So on the 11th of May, two things going on, and you are very welcome to come to one or both. So we're going to have a walk, weather permitting, and then an evening at Handley's, and there will be more information about how to book onto that nearer the time. But remember the date, the 11th of May. And then I know it seems ages away, but the 28th of September, there will be a breakfast down at St. George's with a speaker, yet to be confirmed, but there will be a speaker and a chance to come and have breakfast together. So there are some flyers on the table as you came in. So if you didn't get one, do pick one up and make a note of those dates.